Future Commerce is brought to you by Octane AI. Let me ask you a question. Do you want to leverage more customer data and increase your revenue at your brand? The answer should be yes and yes. And with Octane AI, every Shopify and Shopify Plus merchant can do just that. Learn about your customers and collect buyer profile data with engaging quizzes and create personalized campaigns and flows using Facebook Messenger and SMS. Octane AI has plans for any sized business, and Future Commerce listeners get 10% off your first 6 months. So go sign up right now at octaneai.com/future. That's octaneai.com/future. Future Commerce is brought to you by ShipBob. Put your logistics on autopilot. Go to shipbob.com/futurecommerce and get started today with $500 in free shipping credits. Future Commerce is brought to you by BlueShift. 77% of consumers make brand choices based on personalized experiences. Here's my question, are they choosing you? Well, BlueShift allows e-commerce companies to move from batch and blast and one-size-fits-all experiences to something much more custom. You can find out more today about what BlueShift does for your brand at blueshift.com/futurecommerce. That's blueshift.com/futurecommerce.
Hello, and welcome to Future Commerce, the podcast about next-generation commerce. I'm Brian.
And I'm Philip, and we're here today with the next generation of site payments and one click and the fastest hype train that's ever hit Twitter, as far as I'm concerned. Dom Holland, co-founder and CEO of Fast, is with us today. Welcome to the show, Dom.
Hi, gents. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for being here. And how the heck could anyone not have heard about Fast at this point? As it would be beyond me, especially if you listen to this show. But tell us about Fast.
Sure. So Fast is a one-click checkout for the entire internet with no passwords. So it's a button that appears on website that says Fast Checkout. And when you click it, you instantly buy whatever it is you're looking at. You know, typically the place you'll see it is on product pages next to an add to cart button, but more and more sites are using Fast Checkout offsite as well. Third party sites, publishers, magazine sites, social networks, and so forth.
Very cool. And tell us a little bit about how you got into this. Why you, Dom? How did you end up in this business, and what made you want to tackle the problem of payments?
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, married with two little kids, my youngest son, Coda, my youngest child, my son, Coda, he was one at the time, was in hospital for a few weeks. We had my wife's grandmother, my grandmother-in-law, staying with us. And she was trying to order groceries online back in Australia, hence a funny accent. And she forgot a password and just couldn't check out. This is one of Australia's biggest e-commerce sites, a large grocery chain, supermarket chain, and they just couldn't figure out how to charge perfectly innocent little old lady with a credit card out and purse out. And I just remember thinking it was just a preposterous sort of state of the internet. There's so much friction and archaic process around transacting online. I set out to solve that. Originally, I built a prototype of a passwordless authentication system, solving the very direct pain point that she was having. It didn't make sense if people replicate passwords for every single site. And so I built a sort of network that sat as a password authentication. And it using magic links. So you click a link once, log into the site. Every other site, you get one click login. And really sort of spent, you know, I wasn't designing that to build a venture. I just kind of did it for a bit of fun, I guess. And a lot of people put on Product Hunt, tens of thousands of people use it in a couple of days, realized the pain point is huge, right? And the sort of my view on the world and that authentication is broken really resonated with a lot of people. And sort of dug deep into this pain point and realize that the fundamental pain point isn't passwords. They're a symptom of the larger pain point that we don't scale consumers across businesses, right? And so consumers are continually having to re-identify themselves everywhere they go, whether it's passwords or whether it's typing their name again or date of birth again or credit card details again, all over every time for every business they visit. It doesn't make sense. The internet was, you know, the way that we sort of transacted online, authenticated online, was in an era where we didn't do everything online and it just hasn't scaled. And so, you know, I really set out to solve that and figured I think it's one of the largest single problems on the internet and obviously a large opportunity.
Yeah.
Is there a
an astute person who's been around the industry as long as I have. I've now said, I think the third time since the pre-show started, I'm old, feeling my age these days. I remember this little company that I signed up for back in August of 2000 called PayPal, who theoretically were trying to solve a similar challenge. And these days, you know, is sort of the stateful, always logged in, one click payment. But adoption seems to be a challenge in that space. And, PayPal's not everywhere. Neither is Apple Pay or Google Pay. Why will Fast be everywhere?
Sure. So frankly, I think PayPal's been fairly successful in their approach. They may not be everywhere, but they've done extremely well and built a very impressive business on the back of that distribution. And frankly, that distribution is what keeps PayPal there today, right? It's now a 20-year-old, business, as you sort of alluded to. And, typically the experience, the PayPal experience is still kind of a lagging experience, right? The reason that you still see it in so many places is because of the distribution that they've built. It may not be everywhere, but this is one of the largest sectors in the world, right? Both in terms of number of businesses and number of consumers. So, when you think about all of the big companies you think about in space, Apple Pay, PayPal, Google Pay, and then you think that a company like Alipay processes more than those companies combined, this is just a big market. It's simply not a winner-take-all market in any way, shape, or form. And we've seen that because we've seen a number of extremely large companies in this space. And so I think PayPal's done a really phenomenal job, but I do think that, what they have is distribution, right? I think PayPal has a very prosperous future. I don't think PayPal checkout is that prosperous future for PayPal. I think of PayPal as more of a P&E company these days, or an M&A company, and, their acquisitions like Venmo and Braintree and whatnot are really the largest parts of PayPal. And much like a lot of traditional businesses, they build a big distribution channel and they're like, what other products can we, push through that distribution channel? The fact that they're not on every website, I don't think matters. I do think that it's interesting that things like Apple Pay have actually surpassed PayPal in terms of processing volume, despite the fact that Apple is far more limited in terms of distribution than PayPal. Both in terms of the number of seller websites that they're on, but also, PayPal is a device and is, kind of more similar to Fast, is technology agnostic, right? So you can use PayPal on mobile and desktop. You can use it on Apple or Android, it doesn't really matter, the same as Fast. Whereas Apple is starkly Apple-centric, right? You need an iPhone basically to use Apple Pay. And even if you have an iPhone, if you're using the Chrome browser on your iPhone, it won't work. If you're using a MacBook and using the Chrome browser, like 77% of the internet, it won't work. And so so it is so heavily contextual. And again, Apple is even restricts the banks that you use Apple Pay with to the banks that they've specifically done deals with to pay them, a fee on transactions. So it is so highly limited from a contextual standpoint compared to a PayPal, and yet it's processing a lot, right? And so it gives you an idea of the size of the distribution channel again. But the difference of Apple and the PayPal or us is, Apple doesn't have a single sales rep that's out selling Apple Pay into SME or, mid-market sized businesses. They may be in the very top end strategic side, but they're not, employing large sales forces like a PayPal. And frankly, I don't think they will. Is Apple ever going to be everywhere? No, but no Apple products are. And their intention isn't to be the only solution in market. It's to, sell more products into the distribution channel that they've got again, which is typically iPhone users, right? The difference of Fast is we are completely agnostic, in the same way as the PayPal is, technology agnostic, browser, device, bank agnostic, card. So from that perspective, we're a lot different to an Apple. We are aggressively going after the whole market and building teams and marketing that will address multiple sides of the market. As well as that, we actually have proven we're very good at partnerships as well, right? Stripe is our largest backer, one of the largest payment networks on the internet. We're part of a big commerce, one of the largest e-commerce platforms on the internet. We have a string of unannounced and equally large partnerships as well. We do understand that there's an ecosystem of people for us to work with for distribution at scale, as well as going direct to market, which we are. On top of that, we actually are a very different product. Aside from the fact that it's a button that you would see on e-commerce websites, much like Apple Pay have a button you would see on e-commerce websites and PayPal have a button you would see on e-commerce websites, our products are actually very different and typically target, you know, different pain points. And so whilst we're going after the same sort of market, we do it in very different ways and we have very different products.
Hmm. Actually, let me push on this a little bit further. So we've talked about several competitors and there are even more because as we look, I mean, there are some direct ones out there, Bolt and others. If you look at the market and look where like even e-commerce platforms are trending, Shopify is pushing into payments and some even, mm-hmm. you know, some yeah. would say that it like maybe that is the whole Shopify.
Understatement of the yeah. century, but yes.
And Amazon's yeah. taking share of payment just by nature of having people shop mm-hmm. on Amazon, but also off Amazon. And you know, and even sure. Adobe and some of the other like e-commerce giants out there are starting to push into payments. And so you the space mm-hmm. is big, but it feels like it's like rapidly getting smaller. So, you know, as you sort of, you know, look ahead and look at, you know, where you fit in with platforms, like, how do you see sort of Fast evolving as e-commerce platforms evolve?
Yeah, so there's a lot of interesting things. I think first of all, you know, the last 20 years was really about giving businesses the ability to transact online, right? They basically didn't have that before, especially small businesses, right? It was just frankly like either the infrastructure was not there at all, or, you know, a startup just couldn't access that infrastructure, right? And then the cost of accessing and integrating that infrastructure was too much. And so a lot of that, you know, a lot of the work over the last 20 years was really put into enabling businesses to transact, right? And, but again, it was the same way as like enabling businesses to have membership portals or login systems or whatever. It resulted in like highly fragmented experiences for consumers, right? And for the end user. And so where you see businesses getting into payments, a lot of that is them just consolidating all of the different access points that they accept payments across their portals and properties, right? So less about, you know, I think that some of this is businesses getting into financial services. You mentioned Shopify, very clear that Shopify is becoming a financial services business, right? Or basically is a financial services business. Mm-hmm. Their subscription revenue is fairly flat year on year, financial services revenue through the roof, and they're basically, you know, doing what Facebook and Twitter did 10 years ago and just blocking, closing out everyone in the ecosystem that right. helped build them that is in financial services and saying, this is now ours. And so very clear that they are, but there's a lot of businesses that are doing this just fundamentally as best principles internally and going, how do we just manage financials, you know, payments as an offering for our own properties or for our customers that is part of our ecosystem and that need to transact on our properties. And less about sort of sending this out into the world as a financial services, you know, product that's going to replace their core product, but more as how do they better service their core audience. You know, I think when you think about things like Twitter and whatnot, they're now taking payments for creators and this sort of creator economy, you know, again, it's you know, never say never for something like Twitter. But I think a lot of that is about, again, how do they either monetize their audience themselves and help their audience and creators actually monetize themselves. And so payments is like fundamental to that, right? How do you get money flowing into the platform? But does Twitter, you know, plan on becoming a financial services company? I don't think that's core to their strategy, especially with Jack at the helm of Square as well. Probably doesn't want to create another competitor for his own company. So yeah, I think it's a really interesting space and one that, frankly, is just consolidating within tech companies, realizing how to do payments. You know, payments is a really complex part of the world and part of the tech stack. And I think a lot of companies are just figuring it out.
There's so you mentioned something there that I think is really interesting is around how you're driving. So your go to market is really interesting. And it's probably the thing you're best known for these days, at least on Twitter, in sort of capitalizing on a hype network effect that was building around startups and entrepreneurship already, that perhaps others like Elliot might have proved in building a fan base of people who like to root for those building in public. And I'm going somewhere with this, but I'd love for your validation on that when we get there. Sort of capitalizing on that and this sort of in consumer awareness of what Fast is, but then understanding that the business buyer is also maybe not even in the e-commerce part of an organization, that your business buyer and your buying center is likely in finance. How does that become, it seems like you're appealing to three different types of three levels in very stratified awareness of what payments is and how it actually operates in a business. Does that make you less focused to have to think about three people to market to?
So there's even more complexity than that, but maybe let's break it down a little first.
So
first of all, we, as a business, like our primary value to businesses, right, to merchants, to retailers, to e-com sites, anyone who wants to sell stuff online is twofold, right? The first one is we're the easiest way for people to transact online, fastest way for people to buy. Make it easy for people to buy, more people will buy things, right? Really easy analogy. We have all the case studies backing up. It is so stark. You see, as soon as fast checkout is installed on the site, conversion rate goes like this, and then it saves flight again, right? It's just like instantly within an hour. It's really amazing to see. And so that first value is really beneficial, right? Businesses want to sell more stuff online. How do they optimize their site? How do they sell more stuff? We help them with that core pain point. The second pain point, which again is like probably one of our biggest differentiators, it's something that from here until the end of the year, I think you're going to hear a lot of, but also see a lot more of. I think it's like the most transformative type of technology that's coming through in e-commerce, frankly. And it's one of our most unique aspects. And that is headless checkout, but not headless checkout just in the way, just in the context of saying we're a third-party provider that's going to run your checkout. Headless in terms of how do we take the checkout button you see on our website and actually put it, embed it in a publisher's site, right? So Vogue can write an article about a Burberry jacket, the new Burberry jacket, and have a fast checkout button for the Burberry jacket within the Vogue article, right? Click the button, buy the jacket. The order goes from Burberry, right? Burberry will send you a confirmation email immediately. Burberry has your customer information. If you have ever shopped at Burberry before, you're still sitting in the database and the order is attached to your existing account. You could use Burberry coupon code, but all from Vogue's website, right? And then Vogue could earn an affiliate fee on that transaction. Like this is a magical experience. Suddenly the marketing channels are transactable. And same way, if you're reading a recipe and the chef, the recipe wants to give you the 10-page spiel about the soup bowl that they use before they give you the recipe. But you could buy the soup bowl in one click from the recipe. Now the recipe site doesn't have to build any e-com infrastructure. They're just embedding a checkout button for the product that they bought from Williams Sonoma or some other website, right? They can embed it into their articles and into the recipe itself. And you can buy in one click. Like this really is a great consumer experience, amazing for business and for the publishers who can earn much more in affiliate fees, right? This headless checkout, same thing as QR codes in stadiums to buy the jersey for the team you're rooting for. This is commerce everywhere. One click from checkout, one click checkout from email, one click checkout from display ads. This is the most incredible thing. And to do this, it requires us to not just be a payment token, right? Apple Pay, Google Pay, PayPal, these are payment tokens. So you can call them checkout buttons, you can call them whatever you like. They're payment tokens, right? They replace a credit card, replace you having to use a credit card. They're not integrated with order management systems or catalogs or customers or anything like that, right? And so what happens is a store, if you click an Apple Pay button, the store tells Apple that they need to transact $100 for a certain transaction. Apple charges your card $100 and then goes back to the store and says $100 went through. They don't know what you bought. They don't know, anything about the order. And so that doesn't help. So it means as soon as you go offsite, Apple Pay doesn't work, right? Because it relies on the side being the mechanics is to, manage an order and create an order and do all these sort of things. Same thing as PayPal, same thing as Google Pay. A big difference of Fast is that we actually take all of those things, make all of those things portable anywhere you put the button, right? On any website on the internet, a couple of lines of code. And it's a really huge differential. I can tell you, we've got some of the biggest brands in the country and in the world integrating right now to put headless checkout right across the internet. This is a very large differentiator. Now, where I was going back to in terms of the people we sell to is we'll come back to we have a fourth. We sort of have three spokes, right? Typically, we have buyers and sellers. We think of as our core market. The third spoke for us is kind of publishers now, right? Or third parties. Who are the third parties that we can place these buttons? And instead of just giving retailers or brands the ability to do that, we're also building that network of those third parties. And so we actually have three different parties for us to market and sell to: consumers, businesses, and distribution channels for businesses. But within companies, to go back to your kind of question, there's there's a number of personas that kind of get involved in this, right? The bigger the company, more personas to get involved. If you want to put a a checkout button on the product page, I can tell you there's like 37 teams in some companies that will get involved in that process. It is very complex.
Oh yeah, no, I know.
The typical stakeholders or decision makers that really are working with Fast, that are signing off on Fast, is either heads of product, VPs of product, VP of technology, VP of e-commerce, or VP of marketing, and in some cases, VP of payments. We're actually, I always say we're not a payments company. Yes, payment is part of our service, but we are just not a payments company. And so frankly, most of the time, we're dealing primarily with product technology, e-commerce, and marketing, right? When you think about headless, that's a marketing channel. Now what you're doing is taking checkout and think of it as a marketing channel as opposed to like a cost center from the payments department. And payments is typically like very operational, kind of considering the operational side of payments, cost side of payments, and so forth. And that's, our biggest value drivers for the other sides of the business. And then obviously consumers, right? You've got consumers. Most of our consumer acquisition is done through businesses. So typically a lot of our sort of marketing and sales focus is on the business side, and we acquire consumers directly through product integration through businesses or those third parties. And then to kind of go to your original point about marketing and hype and whatever else, our goal is to build a consumer network, right? The value, if you count forward 5 years, the value of Fast is we have 1 billion consumers using one click checkout every day, right? If you lead a large e-commerce site, you wouldn't use anything else. Why would you use anything else if 1 billion consumers use this one product for one click checkout, right? The value of us is having 1 billion consumers in that network. Our job is very clearly to get 1 billion consumers into that network, right? How do you do that? And so our job is to market our tech to as every business and e-commerce site possible and every consumer possible, right? And almost less aggressively at consumers, more aggressively at businesses, right? But we are, solving a consumer pain point, and we believe that we, and it's a pain point that everyone resonates with, right? No one needs understanding why checkout is hard, retyping all your information is stupid, why passwords don't scale. Like, people get it. And so because of that, we talk to businesses through the lens of a consumer, right? They get it. As a consumer, they understand. As a consumer, they get the friction. As a consumer, they understand that they would be able to transact more easily and buy more things with the problems that we solve. And so then as a business, they want to adopt that technology for themselves because they understand the consumer pain point behind it. It's a really effective strategy, to be honest. Our business, our retail network has grown exponentially since launch in September, continues to grow at an incredible pace. Our FMV, which is the amount of money that we're processing, every day, week, month, is growing at an incredible pace. Consumers are onboarding is too. So it's a strategy that works really well. And I think that, hype is... Twitter's a funny, the Twitter sphere is a funny space anyway. It's kind of like one big toddler that kind of just rolls around looking at like whatever's shiny and whatever they're upset about or happy about for that 2 minutes of time, right? And then they kind of keep rolling around. And I really think that hype is just refers to rapid influx of knowledge about a specific company or something like that, right? Or a specific product or whatever. And I think we managed to get the attention of a lot of people in a very short amount of time and continue to do that. It's ironic because marketing at Fast is outnumbered 25-1 by R&D. We have 25-1 the number of people in R&D, engineers, product design versus marketing, right? And we actually have allocated very little resource to marketing, but we've had outsized returns from a marketing standpoint. We've also had outsized returns from a product and engineering standpoint. We've been pretty successful at implementing like best in class right across the business. And I think a lot of our early marketing success was actually not even designed for the purpose that we're best known for, right? So there's, we had a number of things, and one of the biggest best things we did was just hire creative people early, right? And I think it's really hard these days for startups to just hire creative people. They're looking mm-hmm. for database, rationale for every single decision, whether it's to appease investors or themselves or vanity metrics or whatever it is. and they don't hire creative people or anywhere bullishly as we do. And because it's hard to quantify, at least at an early stage, what the value on sort of pure, raw creativeness is. And we did that early. And, you know, one of the first people we hired in our first 10 was a videographer internally. We did that so that we could recruit. We had a videographer to tell the story of every person that we hired and create marketing videos for the company purely to target talent. And we would put the videos in social media because we're in the toughest talent market in the world and still were at the time and still are. And, you know, the videos themselves, I think, were the first catalyst that got people thinking that we were sort of building in public, which was just by us creating these sort of marketing videos about the company, about the startup, to attract talent. And there was the first piece, you know, Matt Kobach is our director of content. He's a huge personality on his own.
Twitter famous on his own, right? Yeah.
Absolutely. You know, took our existing social presence and then amplified it 10x again. Right. But again, it was like raw creativeness. You know, we didn't give him hard, you know, neither of these people had like very hard sort of database metrics and targets what they needed to achieve. The goal was, you know, promote us through visual medium, promote us through social medium and own those channels, right? They're important channels. They're large distribution channels, own those things. When we first built our checkout, before we even marketed to the first businesses, long before we actually built it, I said to investors when we were still building our login product that when we build checkout, the first thing we're going to do is test it on our own store, so that if anything's wrong, if you know people are buying stuff for free, it's gonna affect us and not the live seller, right? And so we built a store. I said at the time we would be selling caps. And we built a store so we can test it, a swag store. We put, you know, hoodies on there. The cost of us using external user testing platforms is $30 a user a month or something like that, $30 a user. And we had to give them fake credit cards or credit cards that they could use. And then they would put in fake data and test. And it didn't make sense. I thought if we have a hoodie that costs $21 or $28 delivered, if we subsidize the cost of the hoodie, get lots and lots of people buying it, putting in real addresses using their own real credit cards, we can actually run like tests on live consumers at scale and kind of get a good test data on how well the product holds up, how fast it is, the scale that it can work on, and one of the most incredibly difficult things, which is address validation globally, and we did that. So we would, run promos for hoodies and discount them from $20 to $1 or $5 or whatever for a minute or 5 minutes at a time, and designed to like push large numbers of people through our checkout in short periods of time, just at scale. And honestly, we became known for it. We sold over 10,000 hoodies, kind of pre-launch as a company. And so, and then got known kind of for that and for this incredible marketing channel. And it's kind of a really amazing, again, like this is before we had, we didn't even have a head of marketing. We had zero people hired in marketing when we were doing that. Matt Kobach hadn't even come on board at that stage, right? Mm-hmm. This was purely like an R&D-led project designed to test product that ended up in the sort of mass marketing appeal. And of course, we actually have a GM of e-commerce now that looks after our store and our sort of general e-commerce initiatives. We have one person, Gary, who's attached to this and supplies apparel for all of our team around the world or whatever else. But it's really amazing that, how these things came about, like, were kind of less about building hype and actually had like very structured purpose that it just ended up in more broader appeal.
Hey, Philip here to tell you about our newest sponsor, Octane AI. If you are on Shopify or Shopify Plus, and who isn't, am I right? Then you need what Octane AI has to offer. I am a huge fan of guided selling, and Octane AI has tools that allow you to get to know your customers on a deeper level and collect more buyer profile data. And what does that mean? Well, it means that you can use things like shop quizzes, Facebook Messenger, SMS, and opt-in tools to allow you to engage your customer more personally so you can get on their level. More personalized campaigns and flows across all channels means more ROI. And that ROI that is driven from Octane AI is usable in other platforms with their integrations to other tools you're already using. Brands have already seen incredible results. up to 16x increase in email signups and a 28% increase in AOV. That's average order value, money in your pocket. What are you waiting for? Octane AI has plans for any sized business, and Future Commerce listeners get 10% off the first 6 months when you sign up. So why don't you sign up today? Go to octaneai.com/future. Once again, that's octaneai.com/future and tell them Philip sent you. Hey, I just want to jump in here and tell you about our new partnership, Bob. Let me ask you a question. Do you want to grow your e-commerce business by 1,200%? Well, of course you do. But before you tell me that that's impossible, let me tell you about ShipBob. They are a premium 3PL that offers a global fulfillment network, best-in-class technology, and reliable customer support. And here's a real-life merchant story. When Andrea Lisbona, the founder and CEO of the hand sanitizer brand Touchland, partnered with ShipBob, she was amazed by how fast and seamless ShipBob's pick, pack, and ship process really is, even as her business grew 1,200% in a matter of weeks. So outsource fulfillment to ShipBob and watch your business grow in a scalable way. Go to shipbob.com/futurecommerce to get started with $500 in free shipping credits. That's shipbob.com/futurecommerce and get started today. It's time once again for me to tell you about our newest partner, BlueShift. Channel-centric? Siloed? Batch and blast? One size fits all? These are the words no marketer likes to use and no campaign that your customers want to be a part of. So why do these campaigns still happen? Why? Well, disconnected data and disjointed technology. BlueShift's Smart Hub CDP connects data and creates personalized omni-channel experiences for leading brands like James Allen and CarParts.com. BlueShift provides catalogs for AI-driven product recommendations, advanced predictive segmentation capabilities, and creates custom audiences for your first-party data to leverage across almost any media platform so that you, the marketer, can make batch and blast a thing of the past. Learn more at blueshift.com/futurecommerce and get your copy of the Smart Guide to Product Recommendations for e-commerce and retail for free. That's right. Go to blueshift.com/futurecommerce.
Brian, I'm sure you're champing at the bit, but I would like one last thing to say there, which is, sure. I see what you're saying, but I think that there's some brilliance in the execution of, understanding where the audience lies and where you're gaining traction. And I think the hiring of Matthew Kobach really showed me, hey, you're leaning into having a voice, in an unmet need an unmet desire, a thirsty market of people who want to see others succeed, and who want to, learn from those. And whether or not that was your intent in the beginning, I think it's well executed and you leaned into it, to just say, hey, this is where we're going. And, just my own, experience in following you, your Twitter game is extremely strong too. And, it's one of those things where, it can be extremely polarizing to people who just do not like that and don't have an appetite for it. And, I don't know if you know it, but people like love you to death or they kind of hate your guts. And I mean, you, like literally you, I don't know how you deal with that or if you recognize that or not, but that's, it creates sort of a, you can't really sit on the fence and like say, oh, well, let's see how this whole fast thing pans out. There's mm-hmm. people who are like rooting for you and there's people who are rooting against you. What does that do? Does that distract you from building the product?
I say that sadly, one of the truths about being a good founder is having an emotional range between 4 and 6, right? It's one of these hard realities that if things get really tough, you'll never see me running around the room with my sort of screaming at people or head down or, hiding in a closet or whatever. I'm front and center, always here. They sort of stand up. At the same time, anything really fantastic happens in the business, it's it's good, but it's, you know, we have a lot to do, and we just have a big job ahead of us, and we can't get distracted by it, right? And it's sad because that's really the traits of, you know, you see a lot of great founders is and great leaders is that ability to kind of normalize life, right? And across all things. And so, you know, the realities of any body or any company or any organization that has a large profile is they're always going to be polarizing, right? Because population, the general populace is just not the same, right? There isn't a politician in the world, in any historical figure, anywhere in the world that has broad appeal, right? They're always polarizing. It's just human nature. People, you may not like somebody by the way they look, by the way that they say a certain word. It reminds you of something from your childhood, the way they smell, the way they dress. You know, some people have made judgment before, you know, before they have any knowledge. So you can't ever help that. Smaller the profile, less polarizing you are, because the less people that are exposed, you know, to you and have hard views. The bigger you are, not just that people have those views, but then they're more likely to talk about you, right? And so, and talk in public about you. So, frankly, it's, it comes with the job, I think. I think that for a lot of people, it is an incredibly hard thing, challenging thing. And for some people, just frankly, too hard to deal with, right? I think we've seen time and time again, lots of people who go through, you see it. I by no means am sort of on that level, nor is our company, but you see this in like celebrities or, you know, you can see it in like professional sports people who, you know, sometimes have breakdowns. They just can't handle, you know, the sort of public pressure. I think it is truth. Politicians kind of can go through the same thing. You know, I'm here to do a job and let's build this business. And that's what I'm here to do. To be successful in this, again, to build a consumer network scale business, we have to build a very, very large company, a very large consumer network. Lots of people have to know us and know us intimately to be successful. There really isn't another choice in this, right? And if you think about every large consumer network scale business, they all have very polarizing leaders, right? And it's not necessarily that their leaders are more polarizing than the other, but that just that they're the leader of a very large consumer network scale business. And frankly, that's just the reality of being in this position. And I'll tell you what, it's not a very nice thing. And, you know, for my wife, it's, you know, not nice to have to read like terrible things that people say. And for people internally in the business, not nice for them to read, you know, terrible things people say, whether it's about me or the team or whatever. But, you know, I'm the face of it. There's zero time or people that should feel sorry, you know, for me or the company for being polarizing, because that's the cost of building a large business and a large profile, and just something that comes with the territory.
Yeah, with that, I think so many questions. while we're on this line, I think, you know, you've mentioned, you know, sort of the weight this has had on you, and what you have to do to manage this. You've also hired a team and you've got a co-founder. You know, Allison Morrell is your co-founder. I'd love to hear about how you met. Also, you know, how this what you face as a leader affects your whole team, and what kind of, you know, what sort of time commitment is required to address sort of the PR side of things. Like, I would imagine that with sort of the strategy that you've leaned into, there's quite a bit of management of being able to, you know, address what people say or not address it, or just think through it and just understand how to position. And so I would love to hear about that in the context of a larger team.
Yeah. You know, internal comms, you know, is something that, like, especially as we're growing as a business, that will, you know, think about more, and not from a PR spin angle, but more like, you know, we're building a large distributed global team. How do we manage comms quickly at scale? How do we get the right message across, as in get the message across without dilution? How do we do that ideally as close to real time as possible? How do we encourage people to talk up, you know, give us feedback? So I think it's a complex thing just in building a big business and managing sort of that comms generically. I'm a pretty, you know, as an Australian male, I'm a pretty blunt, straight up kind of thick-skinned, you know, guy, and like many Australian males, and that's kind of my style. And so I tell you what, often, you know, I have a phenomenal comms team who do a great job at, you know, at spreading, you know, the stories of FAST, you know, around the world, and help internally. But I'm not a talking points kind of person, right? I'm not a script reader. I'm fairly confident, you know, talking, you know, about FAST. It's number one, it's, you know, one of the biggest topics I could talk about, you know, infinitely. And so I'm pretty common for me to just talk, frankly, with our team at scale. And in that, to that end, it's actually pretty easy. I think as soon as we stop, you know, as soon as the company stops doing that, then it loses a certain luster internally. And I think it's pretty clear to a team that, like, it's just become that big enterprise business that is suddenly being, you know, muted, and which I think is natural at some size. We are just nowhere near there. I think we're decades off being that sort of business. But so to that end, like, the comms, frankly, isn't that difficult for us to manage. What is difficult is getting lots and lots of people together in short notice, or, you know, lots and lots of people to get together to talk. But we do a weekly all hands, which is with our team across the world. And even with people in lots of time zones now, we've got about 200 people as a company, 200 next week. We still get 80% of every person live on our all hands once a week. So we've had a pretty good forum to kind of talk pretty frankly. We have a public Q&A. You can ask a question on the whim. It's all live, real time. Happy answering anything. We have a pretty transparent sort of place with the team.
There's but you're on a trajectory in an industry where I think the goal is to be the big enterprise company. Is it not? Isn't that what Stripe would hope you to become at some point with its backing? And, you know, this rumored $1 billion valuation I read about, which you, I'm sure, won't comment on. But the information is like, FAST discusses $1 billion valuation. It's like you're on the track, right, to become that company, or no?
Well, we're on track to become a large business, yeah. But I mean, I think there's still a difference in, you know, As you know, a lot of things you want to talk about, we do things very differently to most companies, right? And I have no, I'm probably one of the least risk adverse people in the world. And so I have no problem in us just doing things differently. I have no intention to just do things the way other people do, other companies do, just because somebody tells us it's a good idea. And I tell you what, we've got an incredible team of people who've worked at a lot of big companies and held, like, a lot of, you know, very senior roles, a lot of big companies. And even, like, none of them are sort of trying to turn us into this, like, boilerplate enterprise either, right? It doesn't matter how big you are, you know, how fast we're scaling. People understand that FAST has its own personality and has its own way of doing things. It is what, you know, it's the magic of the business, and we're going to keep running it that way. Again, like I said, you know, decades from now, you know, when I'm feeling a lot older as well, then we'll see. We'll see if we can continue to say that we are, you know, innovating at the pace of a 200 person startup. But for now, it's not an issue. Yeah.
Pace of innovation, for sure. I mean, the it's name, it's in the name, it's FAST. So I would hope it would be. Your co-founder is ex Uber and PwC, right? So if there's somebody who knows how to avoid the trappings of a big organization, I'm sure she's got the sights on what to do and what not to do, right? Let's dive into a little bit about you said sort of the network effects of being a consumer, you know, being in a consumer business, having sort of the trust of the consumer, holding the consumer data. How are you, you know, that's an interesting choice these days, you know, to have a consumer brand. So outside of Twitter, how are you going to proliferate that and gain, you know, consumer confidence in them trusting FAST as the place to, you know, and the recognized brand for, you know, for giving you their information and allowing you to, you know, facilitate.
So are we talking like Klarna Super Bowl ads, or, you know,
What marketing channels are we going to have? Well, I'll tell you about an interesting marketing channel that's coming, and not one that I'm necessarily historically a large fan on. But you know, I think there's a NASCAR truck race coming up on June 18th in Nashville, and there will be a fast truck on the track. But I can tell you, it's actually a funny story because the driver of the car, really great, fantastic NASCAR racer, Parker Kligerman, actually found us through Twitter as well. And he's been buying fast merch himself, you know, paying for it himself for a long time and going to races wearing fast gear. As athletes, as a racer, as a professional racer, what else would you want to wear than fast, right? What else would you want to have on your truck? And, you know, so we'll lean in there and kind of get that piece. But, you know, one of the sad realities about, and one that we, you know, hope we can play a positive role in changing, is that consumers care far, you know, too little, far less than they should about security, privacy, right? The reality is, when you're buying a T-shirt online, your risk levels are quite low. If you're in the Western world, most transactions are kind of backed by your bank. You don't really care too much. Everyone sort of, I think, concedes that their email addresses and names are stored in 10 million databases around the world now. And so it's kind of like that ship has sailed. It's kind of a sad state of the world. And, you know, as an example, you know, when Marriott had 500 million people's information leaked, you know, a couple of years ago, the next day there were still people staying in Marriott, right? It's not like no one went and checked into the Marriott the next day. Was there any news on how they were handling data differently or whatnot? No, I didn't hear anything or see anything as a consumer. And I say Marriott's, it's not like there's a problem with Marriott at all, but it's just a good example of where consumers, you know, fundamentally just don't put enough weight in those sites. For that reason, we don't talk a lot about security and privacy externally, right? It's actually not sexy. Not only do consumers not value it highly, it's boring, right? Most consumers find that sort of stuff boring. They're not, you know, the average consumer isn't signing up for a checkout product. It's the most secure checkout product on the internet, or the most private checkout product on the internet. They're signing up for the fastest and easiest one, right? Which is why we're a one-click checkout. But behind the scenes, it's our job to protect consumer data. It's our job to protect consumer payments. And this is typically, I think, the default relationship that consumers have with businesses. It's like a default of trust. And then if the trust is broken, then it's very hard to get that trust back, right? Not just because they've given us that trust, but really we see fundamentally for ourselves to sit as this like identity network that sits in between consumers and businesses. Our job is actually to be like that vault and that central place. We have invested so heavily, like exponentially more heavily for any other company our size, in security and privacy. And I truly mean this. We hired a VP of security before we hired our first engineering manager. About 20% of our R&D team sits in our security org.
After a data breach, as far as I, that's when you make that hire.
Yeah. Exactly, right? And we did this right at the start because we, you know, if you go back and listen to the whole podcast, I've always been saying this. Fundamentally, we are a security and privacy company, right? That's what we do. We hold data. We're not an advertising network. So our commercial model isn't to take your data or find your data from lots of sources and then give it to as many businesses as possible. Our job is you put your data in because you want to use it. And when you click the button, we share that data with somebody that you want to share the data with. That's our business model. And we get paid every time you click the button, right? If you don't click the button, literally zero people get your data. Like it just doesn't go anywhere. It's a fundamentally different model. And I'm on the way there to solve. And I think that not only are we there to protect that, we can actually be champions of security and privacy, right? We can give, because we sit as a network in between the business, we can actually give consumers granular security controls. Like, sure, you can have one-click checkout on your desktop, but maybe then you want biometric on your phone if it's from your work computer or if it's a, you know, payment over a certain amount of money. And retailers aren't investing in that tech, never have invested in tech to do that individually. But we can do that as a company that sits in between and give consumers much better control. And it's a really interesting part of our business. You'll see like evolve over the next, you know, 24 months.
Yeah. As you're talking about this last statement that you've had, I heard a lot of things. And I think it's starting to all sort of like tie together in my head now a little bit. So you said earlier, I mean, a lot of people want to say you're a payments company. You're not a payments company. Then you talked about how you had a NASCAR driver who's buying your brand gear and like wearing it well ahead and found you on Twitter, and then it sort of like led into this idea that like you're actually sort of a security company. There's this question of identity that I think I'm hearing kind of come up. Like, who are you? Yeah. What is the value? And in, as we've described, an extremely like crowded and large marketplace. So with all of the sort of noise in that marketplace and who you are, and like the name, you mentioned the name and like how important that is. And I just couldn't help but think of like the founder when, you know, Ray Kroc's like, you know, I couldn't have done it with the name Kroc. I had to do it with McDonald's, you know, and so as you think about like what your go forward strategy is, and actually kind of what I'm hearing is you're it's almost like you're an identity company. You're, you know, which comes with security and strategy and like or what comes with security and sort of that confidence that you're going to hand over your information too fast. So how important is the name and the brand to you, and what does that mean when you go to market?
Yeah, so lots of different things in that question. I think fundamentally you're absolutely right, and we say this all the time. Actually, when we're talking to merchants, the first thing that I say is we're actually an identity network, right? That's what we do. And the fundamental problem of checkout, when you think about Granny, right, the problem that she had was not a payments problem. Every retailer in the world knows how to take payments, right? They've been doing it for years. It's how they're, you know, established business. There's payment rails exist now. Our great partners at Stripe have built incredible payment rails so the businesses can take payments. That's not an issue anymore. When you go to checkout, when you go to buy something online, the business doesn't know who you are, right? They ask you your name, your email, the same information over and over. That's an identity problem. They're trying to identify who you are so that you can check out, so that they know where to send your package, right? This is purely an identity problem. This is not a payments problem. That's why I say we're not a payments company. Sure, we do payments, but it's like, you know, anyway, so fundamentally, we think that what we're solving is an identity problem. We're an identity network. That consumer network is an identity network. We also have fast login, right? Login accesses that same network. We're an identity network, so you can identify the customer and make them easily, you know, make it easy for them to log in. And you'll see more of these use cases. That is the pain point that we're fundamental pain point that we're solving: scaling consumers across businesses, right? How do you build a consumer network, an identity network to do that? I hate the term identity because in the industry it kind of means something, but for consumers, like, identity doesn't mean anything, right? Or it means so many different things. It actually doesn't mean what like business think it means. But we're building a consumer network to make it easier for you to leverage your data and everywhere you want to leverage it, right? Data and payments. And so I think of identity network as having three things: authentication, payments, and data, right? Which is why we have login, checkout is basically all three in one. But you know, like I said, as far as like consumer, you know, positioning, even business positioning, frankly, is the number one value that we give. The number one reason why you want that network there is for speed, right? It's faster. You don't want to have to enter the information. Frankly, and you talk about market size and crowded space. There should not be a single form on the internet you still have to type your name into, right? It is bewildering how many places we still have to type our name in every single day, right? Online, in person, whatever. We shouldn't be doing it. In a purely digital medium, it is crazy that we're still typing our name, date of birth, things that like haven't changed for me in 34 years, right? So whilst it may be a big space, to be frank, it's wide open, right? In that sort of consumer identity network space, there just frankly isn't one that is solving those problems. When you move address, you just have to tell everyone your new address. That's the current like solution. Is there's no kind of way to do that. You know, if you go to Thailand or Mexico for a holiday and lose your wallet in the surf, you have to tell everyone your new card number. Like, there's just no like other way of doing this. So there isn't a company that's gone in there and built that identity network. And I tell you what, I think the company that does is going to start as a checkout business, right? Checkout is an incredible catalyst to build,
right?
I think, one of the world's biggest identity networks.
I would agree with that, because I think it's the logical place where those three need states and those three very broken things about the sort of stateless being of the web converge. Mm-hmm. What does Fast of the Future look like then? You solve those things. What happens next?
Yeah. So, you know, really simple. You know, I like to say anywhere that you would currently type your name, that will be replaced by a fast button. Anywhere you'd have to type information or make a payment, that'll be fast, whether it's in person, you know, or online. And, you know, when you think about it as well, like unlocking, you know, you, a front door or a smart lock in an office or, you know, whatever is actually the same thing as unlocking a website. It's identifying that you have authentication, open that door, or open the website. Like, it's the exact same thing. So, you know, when you think about authentication, payments, and data as those three like generic buckets, is a very wide field of opportunity. And so for us, when you think about our business in that state, one of the hardest things for, you know, at a high level is, where do you start? What do you focus on? What do you build? And what do you do and what do you don't do? And so, you know, strictly to kind of remain focused and to make sure that we're, serving the right pain points now is we have created the concept of dinosaur eras at Fast. And so, and we're in the e-commerce era of Fast, right? So we're using this identity network to build, to solve e-commerce problems for buyers, sellers, publishers, anyone in that sort of e-commerce sphere. And that's the big era, you know, era that we're in now. We haven't announced the end date to the era or the next era that'll come, but currently we're in the e-commerce era. And, you know, but our business will evolve and we'll broaden the use cases for identity, both within e-commerce over the sort of short to medium term and then longer term into other sectors.
Ooh, Dom, thank you. This time went
way too fast.
Fast. It's been a pleasure. Thank you for being just so transparent, and thank you for sharing all your thoughts. And
thank you both.
Hey, I wish you the best of luck, man. It seems like a place that's ripe for innovation, and that seems like you guys really understand what you're trying to get, and I wish you the best to do it.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
You got it.
Thanks, Dom.